Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
It's Kevin Sheehan on the Team 980 and the Odyssey app.
Greg Wyshynski is the senior ESPN writer covering the NHL, and he joins us here. We will get to the Caps in a moment, but seriously, is there anything more exciting than a seventh game overtime in the NHL playoffs? I mean, this is your thing, but even for just a sports fan, it's incredible, and last night was really exciting.
Not for the teams that lose.
We got an issue with Craig's phone. Every once in a while this happens with our connection, so we will reestablish the connection. But the Rangers last night, in a 3-1 comeback in that series, they trailed Pittsburgh in the series 3-1. Crosby missed some time, but he was back last night. 4:46 into overtime last night on the power play. They got a goal to oust Pittsburgh 4-3. Do we have Greg back? All right, Greg.
Hello?
We got you now, and you sound normal, which is
okay.
Which is good for you. Yeah, which is good for you. All right, incredible game last night. Incredible series, right? Incredible first round of the NHL playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, for a number of reasons. I mean, not the least the fact that we had so many game sevens, which is pretty intense and pretty amazing. But also, obviously, from an offensive perspective, it was the highest scoring, you know, it's on track to be one of the highest scoring playoffs that we've had since the early 1990s. And that was kind of a question coming in, you know, what was it going to look like after we had a regular season with the highest goals per game average since 95-96? Was it going to carry over? What it was going to look like? And I think it's safe to say that not only has it carried over, but it's actually gone up. So some of the game sevens were a little bit tighter, obviously, than the rest of their series had been. But for the most part, we're still seeing incredible amount of goal scoring for a Stanley Cup playoff.
Have we ever seen two game sevens same night both go to overtime like last night?
That's a question for the stat boys.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. But it is a thrilling thing. I was at the Ranger game last night against the Penguins. It was fun because the games the previous night, I think, were a bit more practiced and measured, right? Like, I think that the Leafs Lightning game was a study in execution and effectiveness. And the Oilers game against the Kings was this game in which the Oilers played probably their best defensive game of the series. And the Kings really couldn't get anything going. And then last night, I thought that the Penguins-Rangers game was very much more in the mode of, like, cuckoo bananas playoff games of, like, you know, controversial goal reviews and you know, a guy who hadn't played since mid-April starting game seven after missing the entire series with an injury. Like, it was definitely much more in the narrative greatness of what the Stanley Cup playoffs bring versus kind of what we saw the previous night. And then obviously in the Calgary game, you get a different, you know, taste of storytelling, which is the Jake Oettinger performance last night,
yeah,
which was one for the ages.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just incredible and not easy saves. I mean, you know, like I think Daryl Sutter, the Flames coach, said the other night, said last night, you know, when you get 100 shot attempts on somebody, you probably should win the game. And that's kind of where Oettinger was. So it was, you know, 2 days of really good hockey, but I think day two was more my style of big storylines and incredible performances.
We'll get to the Caps here in a moment. Did you think that Gensel goal should have stood? It seemed to me the stick was above the crossbar, and it was an incredible play. Just the hand-eye, foot-eye with, you know, him using his skate to kick the puck up into the air. I thought that was going to get overturned. What did you think?
Well, a lot of us have often talked over the years whether the NHL should have a provision on for awesomeness. You know, if you score a goal, it looks really wicked awesome. You should just stand. You should just be able to. You know, there should be a provision that overrules any rule in the rule book, and that would be the case last night. But it's tough to say. You know, it's not where your stick is, where you strike the puck. And so the sense I got in asking around last night was that maybe some people thought that the NHL thought the replay was inconclusive insofar as being emphatic enough to overrule what was ruled on the ice. But the NHL's ruling officially was that they felt that he did not strike the puck with a high stick, which, again, looking at the replay and all the available angles to us, I'm not quite sure if that's accurate. But they let it stand, and it ended up being one of the best goals of the postseason. That was an incredible feat of coordination by Gensel.
Yeah. One more before we get back to the Caps. The disappointment of Toronto, you know, having the opportunity the other night in overtime to close out Tampa Bay in Game 6 and being up 3-2 in that series and still now not having won a series since 2004. Is Tampa just better?
Yeah, I get a little
some activity, but I think we've got a disagreement on the Gensel goal.
Yeah, clearly. Obviously somebody likes underdog. The thing about Toronto, and again, like I tweeted this out after the series was done, is like I'd run it back. I just don't understand the idea of trying to look at this season and say, okay, you know, they've not gotten out of the first round for I think it's now been 4 or 5 years, and obviously this one should be the breaking point. I mean, if last year wasn't the breaking point where they squandered a 3-1 lead against Montreal, you know, doesn't mean that this one should be the breaking point because they lost to a 2-time Stanley Cup champion in a Game 7. I mean, it happens, right? Should they kick themselves for not closing out the series in 6? Definitely. They had an opportunity to, but the Lightning are the Lightning. I saw a lot of this series. I saw a lot of the Boston-Carolina series. I think if Boston played Toronto, the Leafs would be in the second round right now. They just happen to run into a team that is one of the most efficient playoff assassins that we've had come down the pike in a very long time. And they found a way to get through. And so, you know, are there changes you could make? Yeah, I think there are. I think you could take a look at the defense and wonder if maybe you could move off of Morgan Riley. You could probably take a look at John Tavares and wonder if there's a way to move on from him. Because I didn't think that signing was all that smart to begin with because I felt it was sort of redundant. With Austin Matthews being on the roster. But if you wanted to run it back with the same crew with some augmentation next season, I'd have no problem with it because they were such a great team in the regular season and they just ran into an opponent that knew how to beat them.
We're talking to Greg Wyshynski, senior NHL writer at ESPN, at Wyshynski, Wyshynski on Twitter. All right, the Caps got eliminated by the Panthers on Friday night at home in overtime. Another Carter Verhaeghe goal in overtime to win it. Before we get to sort of the big picture on the Caps, is it fair to say, is it accurate to say that this series could have gone either way and the Caps were dead even in the way they played with the Panthers over 6 games?
I think the Capitals did a good job getting the Panthers to sort of doubt themselves a little bit in the series. And then they did a really bad job in the sense that they allowed the Panthers to reclaim their identity. And by that, I mean, when the Capitals had them dead to rights, I believe it was game 4, correct? When they had the lead that they blew.
3-0 in game 5. Game 4 was the 2-1 that they allowed them to tie.
In both games, they blew the lead. But that's in particular, game 4, to allow the Panthers to rally to tie the game and then to allow the Panthers to win the game, I think kind of gave the Panthers what they needed insofar as proof of concept. Like, okay, we're still this team that if we get down early against somebody, we're going to be able to come back because our offense isn't going to fail us. We're going to find someone to score. We're going to find that hero. We're going to find our game again. And I thought game four was the real key to the series in the sense of like, okay, now we've got some proof of concept. So when they get down 3-0 in game five, well, then they come roaring back and win the game, like without missing a beat. That's what we saw from them all regular season. So I kind of feel like the Cowboys did a pretty good job in some cases in this series. But they really kind of just allowed the Panthers to figure themselves out in a way that really efficient playoff teams shouldn't, and gave them enough time and space to sort of recapture that vibe from the regular season. And I think that's where they lost the series.
So big picture, what's next? You know, it's an aging team, obviously, in spots, but Ovechkin's going to set the goal-scoring record in a Caps uniform. I think we all understand that, whether it takes, you know, two more years or three more years, that's certainly the plan. But what do you think is the best course for this organization moving forward to get out of this fourth, you know, this situation they've been in where they've been ousted in four straight first rounds since winning the cup?
Yeah, where do they go from here? I think Brian McClellan hit the nail on the head, which is that there definitely needs to be some turnover on the roster in some places. Obviously, you're hoping to get a little younger, maybe a little bit faster in some places. The goaltending situation is fascinating because I know he mentioned that it's a place that might get addressed. I mean, they're not going to be alone in that. And I'm not sure if there are as many options available to them as there were last offseason for a lot of these teams. We saw a goalie carousel really, really spinning. So I don't know. I mean, they've got a lot of contracts that are going to be tough to move. And they've got a core of a team that obviously likes each other and wants to figure things. And it's just really interesting to look at the Caps and look at the Penguins and see such a parallel track where they lose last night to the Rangers and all the conversation to, okay, Malkin's a free agent, Letang's a free agent, Rust's a free agent. Is this the end of the run? And the Capitals obviously contractually aren't at that point yet, but you have to wonder spiritually if they're both kind of in the same place right now.
On the goaltender thing, because McClellan did say this, that this is a priority for them, how hard will it be to either to trade for somebody or sign one here in the offseason?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, like last offseason, we had a slew of goalies that were free agents, and then we had a number that were available. I mean, I think it was an obscene number, like over a dozen goalies changed teams last offseason, and some of them, you know, fairly big names. I mean, we're talking about Fleury, we're talking about Grubauer, we're talking about Darcy Kemper going to the Colorado Avalanche. So, you know, some of it is going to be contingent on who's available, and sometimes the salary cap is going to maybe necessitate that or escalate it. I mean, you're going to see names like Alexander Grigoriev, for example, the Rangers. I think we'll finally move on from that team, knowing that he's never going to get the starting job there with Shishkin there. So it'll be interesting to see who's available, but there definitely will be the chance to upgrade, I think, given that every team seems to have two goalies. It's just a matter of, you know, what the asset management looks like in acquiring a goalie and whether you really believe that it will be an upgrade over Samsonov or Vanecek.
What about a big name player that they might move on from? I was reading a lot over the weekend about Lars Eller. I was reading a lot about John Carlson, who obviously has the offensive, production, but has the huge contract. Do you think there's a chance they move on from, a big name player in the offseason?
I think there's always the chance, especially given the stagnation of their success in the playoffs and knowing that in order to break out of that, you probably have to make a significant move. And in order to make a significant move, you have to move a significant player. Eller, I think, is entering the last year of his deal, if memory serves, which I think is probably why, everybody goes to Cap Friendly and looks at the contracts and says, okay, this guy should be moving, but he does so many good things for them. It's hard to really think that they'd improve themselves all that much by moving on from him. Carlson's an interesting name only because what he does even if it's not exactly the most defensively efficient play, what he does is such a rare asset in this league insofar as quarterbacking the power play, insofar as moving the puck, and all of the things that make John Carlson Jordan Carlson, that it is kind of intriguing to think, okay, if somebody believes that's the last piece of their puzzle, what would they offer up for it, and how could that help repopulate this roster in the way the Capitals want to? I think that's at least an intriguing option for them, although, again, when you think about what is best for this team, is it to keep this core together until it completely just falls apart physically.
All right, two more for Greg Wyshynski. Like, what is the future of the Capitals? Like, if they largely run it back with the most notable of players, is this still, like, you know, an after top five Eastern Conference team at best?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I don't think all of a sudden they're going to start rocketing up the standings, especially with what looks like a really good run for the Hurricanes and Rangers for the next few years, based on the age of their core and, you know, everything else that's making those teams successful, in particular the Rangers. But you know, I think where they are right now is sort of that post contender tier that we see teams like the Penguins, for example, on, which is to kind of just get in, right, and then see what happens. And in the Penguins' case, they came one goal away from it working, which is, you know, to their credit, the Capitals didn't. But I think when your core is this age, when you've got these contracts in your books, when you're clearly in the you know, sunset years of the careers of some of the biggest stars that we've had in the league in the last 20 years, it's kind of a weird place to be. You could maybe like aggressively reshape the roster around some of these guys. But I mean, if we're being honest with ourselves, like you said, the next couple of years are going to be about Ovi breaking the record. And then the next thing will happen for this franchise. And that's okay. I've seen a lot of criticism of like Capitals fans lately. And I don't quite understand it, about like not about being, you know, content or something with the way that the current state of the team. And I'm like, the afterglow of the cup is still there. I mean, I think if we're being honest, and they're in the last stages of watching the greatest player that will ever play for the franchise assaulting what was seen as an unbreakable record. And if that's okay, then who cares, right? Like I think we all know that until Ovechkin's not playing here, this team's going to be a certain thing, and then when he's not playing here anymore, it'll be the next thing.
Yeah, I think it's that, you know, you'd much rather have what you had, but at the same time, you'd much rather have more. I mean, even if
sure.
It was just one cup, it would have been nice over these, you know, many years now if maybe they made at least two or three other Eastern Conference finals rather than having every other season be a season that they didn't get out of the second round.
Right. No, but I understand that. But I also think that's sort of moving the goalposts a little bit, as my friend Japers Rink said the other day, which is that for years we were obsessed with Ovi winning a cup. Got to win a cup. You know, when he goes to the Hall of Fame, what a heartbreaker it will be
right. If
he has to go in without having won. And then he wins one, and now we're like, well, you know, legacy-wise, boy, we wish we could have had two. And that might be true, but, like, I mean, he did the thing. They did the thing. They won the cup. They won the cup with Ovechkin on the team. And I think that when you look at this franchise and you look about how hard it is to win the cup, and you think about the – you know, there were years when, yeah, you can point to it and say they blew it, like, against Montreal and some of those other disappointing losses, but – you also had the Penguins, which was a dynastic team in that decade, standing in front of you. And then, you know, they get through them and they win the cup. And I don't know, man. Like, I just think that there are so many franchises in this league that struggle every single year. We just talked about Toronto, right? To even play in a championship round, let alone win the Stanley Cup. And then the Capitals do it. And I don't know if there should be any disappointment in the latter years of the Ovechkin era, because they accomplish something that very few teams can, and I think that's fantastic.
Well, it's a far different conversation, obviously, that because they won the cup. I mean, the conversation,
sure,
had they not won the cup, you know, about not only Ovechkin, but the franchise would be far different. I think part of it is just, you know, following the cup, four straight first-round losses. Like, I think maybe the conversation with the fans that you're talking about, and this isn't me because I'm not a hardcore fan, but it would be different if there was, you know, a second round loss, a trip to the Eastern Conference Finals, and two first round losses. It would seem a little bit different, but it's been four straight in the first round and following the cup. For me, though, like it seems like 4 years ago was only a year ago. So I hope you're right that the afterglow of that still is a part of the conversation, because it doesn't seem that long ago.
But you bring up an interesting point, which is the philosophical conundrum for a sports fan, which is that, would you rather see your team compete every year and make the playoffs, or would you rather see them go in the tank and cycle back? And the juxtaposition between what the Capitals did, which is to compete every year, is the Los Angeles Kings, where, you know, the Kings won a couple Stanley Cups. The core of that team, Kopitar, Gowdy, Quick, Brown, until this season because he's retiring, remained there. They went in the tank. They disappeared from the playoffs for more than a few years, and they built up this collection of prospects that is now one of the best in the league. And so they had a window, and it might extend to next season, to kind of have the youth and the veterans click at the same time, right? And the Capitals decided not to do that. And so philosophically, I think it's worthy of a conversation of, like, you know, once you realize that, you know, after like the second year losing in the first round, maybe you take a step back to make a leap forward. But at the same time, if you're a Capitals fan, and if you're the Capitals and you know, seeing the coffers of your season ticket and single game ticket money, you know, filled every year by being competitive, you know, is it the better decision to just try to get in it and win it versus taking a step back and then trying to take a leap forward?
Yeah, it's like one of those things that we always debate as sports fans. It's like, it's so much easier to answer after the fact, because going into it, I think everybody would say sustained success. I mean, over the you know, let's make the playoffs, you know, for the next eight straight years and take a swing at it. But if you go 0-for-8 and you never win the cup, then you're asked the question, no, I'll take the cup in only four playoff trips. I mean,
you don't want to be like the old LA Clippers, right? You don't want to, like, or the a better example, the old St. Louis Blues, right? They're just like made the playoffs every year and they're just there. It's a cameo appearance and nothing ever comes of it. In the Capitals case, something came of it, right? So I think that there's a legit question to be asked of, maybe after you do that, you take a step back and retool, or maybe it's tough to really gauge when you should do it. I mean, for goodness sakes, I don't think after they won the cup, anyone would have predicted this run of first round losses, for example, but there definitely is a template for it from other teams in this league to keep an aging core together and then, you know, take a step back for a couple of years and try to build around them.
Yeah, and there's a difference even in what you discussed, which is, you know, just being the perennial playoff team that really isn't threatening. The Caps have been, you know, the favorites multiple times after great regular seasons. So that also puts context to it. Like, if you're making the playoffs every year and ultimately don't win the cup, but you were great and you were legitimately there, it creates incredible angst and disappointment after the fact. But you had legitimate chances when you got there. And, the NHL, I think everybody has a legitimate chance when they get there anyway. You and I have talked about that for years. But, I think the context with Washington wasn't just that they were a playoff team all these years that they didn't win the cup. It's that they were legitimate contenders in most of those years going into the postseason.
Yeah, no, for sure. And you know, I think, I mean, contenders, being a contender is obviously like in the eye of the beholder. I mean, they come into the series against the Panthers, and I think probably the majority of the punditry probably picked the Panthers in the series. And,
sure.
and I'm not quite sure what the betting market told us beforehand or what have you. But it's an interesting discussion to have as far as like what their modus operandi should have been in the last 4 years. But I don't know. It's hard for me to really, even with these playoff losses, it's hard for me to really kind of frame anything that's happening with this franchise as being disappointing, because it was just what they achieved.
All right, I think you still have your Stanley Cup champion alive, and that is Florida. I think you picked them over the Wild, right, in the Stanley Cup final?
Yeah, the Wild didn't make it. The Wild was a tough one because I really thought that based on the analytics that I saw that they were going to be able to get by the Blues. What I didn't anticipate was Fleury not playing to his standards, and Dean Evason, who I think is a really good coach, kind of fumbling the bag with his goaltending. I think Talbot probably should have started that series, and then you go to Fleury if you need him. But I think when you have Fleury and you've made that trade and he's Fleury, they probably felt that he should start game one. And it's not necessarily where they lost the series. I think the Blues played extraordinarily well, but they didn't help themselves with that decision, I don't think.
Thanks for doing this, as always. That was a great night of hockey last night. Disappointing for the Caps on Friday night, but we'll talk again soon. Thanks, Greg.
You got it. Thank you.
Yep. Greg Wyshynski, everybody, senior NHL writer at ESPN, at Wyshynski, Wyshynski, on Twitter. I want to tell you about Loan Pronto. If you're shopping for a new home, the last thing you want is another surprise jump in mortgage rates. I'm excited to tell you about Loan Pronto's all-new rate protection program. You get a rate quote that is locked in for 90 days. Brian and Amy did it. They locked in an APR in the threes with Loan Pronto. When they finally found a home to put an offer in on, a month later, rates had already jumped into the fours. Many of you are dealing with this right now. They were protected thanks to Loan Pronto, and they saved over $200 a month on their payment. With Loan Pronto's rate protection guarantee, you can make offers with confidence, and there's no fee for this, no upfront cost. And most home buyers who go with Loan Pronto, they save about $3,000 in closing costs. Call now for the all-new rate protection program so you can check rate increases off the list of things to worry about. Call them at 571-775-1810 or go to loanpronto.com. That's 571-775-1810, 571-775-1810. They're an equal housing lender, NMLS 1661781, subject to lender approval, NMLS Consumer.
It's Kevin Sheehan on the Team 980 and the Odyssey app.
Are you ready?
So we spent some time on Friday talking about the NFL schedule, and then I spent some time last hour breaking down Warren Sharp's description of the schedule, which was based on, now that we have the schedule, and most people think it's not important, Warren Sharp went into a deep dive on something he calls the net rest advantage or disadvantage. It essentially counts up the days that you have an advantage over your opponent on rest days leading into the game, and adds up those days where you have a disadvantage. You end up with a net number, and Washington's number is minus one for the year. And the Bills have the best net rest opportunity at plus 12 days. But Washington's got a couple of big disadvantages that we discussed. They've got three short week road games, meaning off a Sunday, playing Thursday night on the road like they will Chicago, or off of a Monday night playing on the road the following Sunday. So there's some disadvantages as well. And they also play four games this year against teams with net 3-day advantages. And they are one of only three teams that has to do that. So on an individual game basis, they're going to play four times this year where their opponent will have 3 days extra rest. I found some other tidbits related to the schedule this year that I did not have on Friday that I wanted to share with you. Number one is this. The four AFC West teams, I think we all have this sense that the AFC West, certainly from a quarterback standpoint, but from a team standpoint, with the Chiefs, the Chargers, the Raiders, and of course, that would be, what team did I just miss?
Broncos.
The Broncos. Thank you. With Russell Wilson, that they've got, you know, Mahomes and Carr and Herbert and Wilson. They are going to play, an amazing number of primetime games. 19 primetime games for the four AFC West. It's the second most ever during the Super Bowl era. And the reason I bring this up is that I was curious to find out what the most was during the Super Bowl era, because the NFC East, I think, during the Super Bowl era has probably played, I don't know this for a fact, but it's probably played the most primetime games of any division. Now, the Super Bowl era has included, you know, a revision to the divisions. You know, the NFC East at one point, part of a three-team division conference in both the AFC and the NFC, had the Cardinals in the division as part of a five-team division. But the bottom line is, when you add up the, you know, the primetime appearances, the Cowboys probably have more than any, and Washington, the Giants, and the Eagles have all played many over the years. Well, the 19 primetime appearances for the AFC West in 2022 is the most, second most during the Super Bowl era. The most being the NFC East in 2015 played 20 primetime games. Now, the NFL research put this out, and I found what the other years of significant numbers of primetime appearances were. And my hunch was correct, that during the Super Bowl era, there have been six divisions during the course of an NFL season to combine for 19 primetime appearances, or six times it's happened. This year, the AFC West with 19, the most ever in 2015 by the NFC East. The other four seasons, 2017, 2010, 2008, 2007, 19 primetime appearances by all of them by the NFC East. So the six most primetime appearance seasons, five of them are the NFC East. And again, that is driven a lot by the Cowboys. But Washington, over during the Super Bowl era, along with the Giants and Eagles, have played a ton of primetime appearances as well. There were a couple of other, you know, I mentioned that Washington's back-to-back games was a scheduling, you know, aberration, anomaly, however you want to describe it, when they play the Giants and then have a bye week in week 14 and then play the Giants again. They play the Giants basically in back-to-back games, even though they have a week in between, which is the bye week. The Giants actually play a game. This is the one big net rest advantage game Washington has off of their bye week. The Giants do play the previous Sunday, so Washington has net 7 days of rest going into that game. But I wondered if this had happened much, and I remember that Baltimore did it against somebody recently, and actually the back-to-back games against the same opponent is only the second time in the last 31 seasons that that's happened. And last year was the other time, and that was when the Browns and the Ravens faced each other in back-to-back weeks. And I think the Ravens may have had a bye week in between that as well. By the way, the week 14 bye week is the latest bye week for teams since they expanded to 32 in 2002. The Falcons, Bears, Packers, Colts, Saints, and Washington all have the latest bye week that we've had in the NFL since 2002. That's a very late bye week for Washington. But it also comes as a setup to, as Warren Sharp described, playing four late season games, three of them in their last four, but they play four late season games in which they will be at a net 3 day rest disadvantage. But you know, because of the 17 game schedule with the bye week, you still have four games left, a month worth of regular season games off of that very late bye week. I would imagine that any coach would tell you that they would prefer their bye week to be sometime in the middle of the season, so they get, you know, a true bye week, a true rest to regroup for the second half of the season. But really, more than anything else, in hindsight, coaches will tell you, they'll be able to tell you after the fact as to whether or not they got the bye week at the right time. You know, were they banged up following a specific game or a couple of games in a row where they desperately needed the bye week to get healthy prior to the next, you know, stretch of games? That bye week could come, you know, in week 5 or it could come in week 10. But week 14 is awfully late. I mean, Washington will have played 13 regular season games in a row before having their bye week. I do think that eventually when the NFL adds an 18th regular season game, which I do think will happen when, I don't know, probably the next collective bargaining agreement. But at that point, the NFL will likely go to 2 bye weeks, because if you do the math on the 18-week regular season, that gets you to President's Day with the second bye week for Super Bowl weekend. And I think ultimately they'd love to be able to play the Super Bowl on President's Day Sunday, and then the entire country have the day off following the Super Bowl. All right, when we come back, there was a conversation that my good friend and former 980er, Tim Murray, had with a sportsbook director on his show out in Las Vegas on the Visa Network that dealt with home field advantage in the NFL and how the odds makers look at home field advantage. There was something specific said about Washington. I'll share that with you when we come back. And we got a few other things to finish up the show with. It's Kevin Sheehan Show, Team 980, team980.com. We are also on the Odyssey app. I'm going to tell you first about BetMGM. BetMGM is the king of sportsbooks, and they're unleashing the spirit of Las Vegas with BetMGM Rewards. Every time you make a wager at BetMGM, you can earn BetMGM Rewards points that you can redeem for online bonus credits, like free bets, and risk-free tokens. Planning a trip to Vegas, you can also convert your BetMGM points into MGM Rewards points that you can use towards dining, shows, and hotel rooms at over 20 MGM Resorts properties located on the Las Vegas Strip and nationwide. BetMGM Rewards is sports betting's premier loyalty program, featuring exclusive offers, incredible experiences, valuable perks, all when you wager on the BetMGM app. Sign up with BetMGM or log on today to get an even bigger piece of the action with BetMGM Rewards. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. Must be 21 or older to wager. D.C. and Virginia only. Please gamble responsibly. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-522-4700.
It's Kevin Sheehan on the Team 980 and the Odyssey app.
So, Tim Murray, who used to work here at 980, does a show with Sean King. We had Sean King on the show a few weeks back. Sean was an NFL quarterback with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and now he co-hosts a show with Tim Murray on the Visa Network out in Las Vegas. They do it from the Circa Sportsbook, which I've not yet been to, but I've heard is spectacular. So Tim and Sean on their show last week had a gentleman by the name of Chris Andrews on their show. He runs South Point LV. It's a sportsbook out in Vegas. And they were talking and having a conversation about home field advantage in the NFL. And Tim Murray specifically said, well, what's FedEx Field worth to the spread? You know, typically over the years, home field advantage offers 3 points to the home team by odds makers. You know, it's not just the crowd advantage that you have, but it's playing at home in a place that's familiar without having to travel on turf that's familiar, locker rooms that are comfortable, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of it does have to do with, you know, crowd influence on the game and how much harder it is for a team that travels. You know, Aaron Rodgers talked about this during the pandemic as to one of the reasons that, you know, there was a lot more scoring, especially by road teams. And he said, you don't have to you know, use hand signals in road games during the pandemic. It's a totally different deal. It is so much easier to play. So typically most teams in the NFL, the significant majority of teams, get somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 points for just being the home team in terms of the point spread. Well, Murray asked, you know, this guy, Chris Andrews, about FedEx Field, and he said that quote, I grudgingly give them 1 point for home field advantage, but I'm not sure I should even give them that. They haven't had a home field advantage since they left RFK, closed quote. Now, we have known for a few years now that the odds makers do not give Washington much of a benefit of being at home or playing at home. I mean, the reasons are obvious. There isn't much of a crowd, and when there is a crowd, at very best for Washington, it's been a neutral crowd. You know, there have been as many fans rooting for the opponent as there have been for the home team. And that's why odds makers, and we had the gentleman from Hollywood Sportsbook and Casino up in Charlestown, Eric Zimney, tell us this either last year or the year before, that Washington is very much discounted as a home team compared to the rest of the NFL. I think he said Washington and Jacksonville are the two teams that are discounted significantly from the rest in terms of the amount of credit given to them for playing home games. So I use this not because it's revealing. I think most of you that pay attention to this stuff have understood this. Some of you it may be a surprise to, but the reasons for it being a surprise can't be that much of a surprise. Washington really hasn't had a home field advantage in a game in a few years. Now, Chris Andrews saying since RFK is a stretch. Washington, many years at FedEx Field, got the full 3-point credit for being the home team. I mean, Washington led the league in attendance for several years in a row with the largest attendance possibility, you know, when you go back to the opening of FedEx Field and for the first 10 years of FedEx Field. And those were mostly Washington fans. You know, we started to see towards the end of the aughts, you know, the famous Pittsburgh, you know, terrible towel takeover on Monday Night Football that 1 year. And then we started to see it slowly happen with lots of other teams as well. And now, obviously, the erosion of just Washington fans showing up at games has been, you know, significant in the last 5 years in particular. But there was a time in which FedEx Field was given the full 3 points. Now, segueing into next season's week one point spreads. Remember, we told you when Washington, when it was announced, that when the schedule came out on Thursday, the week one lines came out. And Washington opened up as a 3.5-point favorite over Jacksonville. That was low to me. I figured it would be, you know, six, somewhere in that neighborhood, maybe even seven. Because Jacksonville is supposed to be one of the worst teams in the NFL. They probably were a double-digit underdog last year, Brendan, as much as anybody was. You know, maybe Detroit being the other one. And I just thought, even if it's perceived as a neutral field environment for the opener, that Washington was going to be a 6-point favorite. Well, they opened as a 3.5-point favorite. That seemed very low. Now, jump to as high as 5 in spots, 4.5 in a lot of spots by late Thursday, early Friday. And by the way, I do know it's May 16th. I understand that. I do understand that we've got 4 months until this game will be played. But the line almost everywhere, and I just noticed this after Murray had sent me this interview that he did with this Chris Andrews. It's back down to 3.5 almost everywhere. So a lot of people came back, more likely than not, a lot of sharp people came back and bought Jacksonville at 4.5, 5. And now the line's back to 3.5. So what will happen? Remember last year I told everybody that I think the Chargers opened as like a 1.5-point favorite in the opener. I said that's going to be Pick'em or Washington minus one by the time we get to the opener, because I think there's going to be some optimism about Washington. The defense from 2020, the fact that Ryan Fitzpatrick has played his best two seasons in the previous two seasons. And I was right about that, that Washington actually week one of last year went off as a favorite in week one against the Chargers. They ended up being a 1-point favorite. I think they may have climbed to as high as a 2-point favorite in that game over the Chargers after opening up it as a 1.5-point underdog. I think I'm right about that. I didn't look at that. I should probably look at that to see if I'm right. But I'm pretty sure they went from a 1-point dog all the way to a 2-point favorite, or close to a 2-point favorite. Anyway, my guess on the Jacksonville line, Brendan, by week one is that it'll be right about where it is now. That it's not going to go up that much. See, there's a big, big disparity right now between Twitter, which is not representative of much, but with respect to Washington Commanders fans, what Twitter believes Washington's going to be, which, you know, people keep sending me these tweets and people keep tweeting me to get on board, Sheehan. This is the year. I mean, some of you have them winning 11 or 12 games with this schedule. You really got excited after the schedule came out. Like you didn't know who the opponents were going to be before. But there's a big difference between what the odds makers in Vegas believe, over-under for the season being 7.5. By the way, it's the exact same number that the Giants have now at almost every book, Brendan. The Giants are at 7, 7.5 almost everywhere as well. The Eagles are 8.5. The Cowboys are 9.5. You know, we know that there's a pretty big difference between a game and an over-under total as it relates to, you know the odds makers. If you've got a full game difference between you and your next team, they believe that team to be solidly better. If it's 2 points difference, they believe that team's much better. So they believe the Cowboys are much better than Washington and the Giants, and that the Eagles are better. It doesn't mean anything. They're going to play the games. They're playing the games. We understand that. But I think that this Jacksonville line, early on, my gut is it's not going to change much at all. I think Washington, by the time we get to opening day, unless, of course, you know, barring Trevor Lawrence breaking a leg in preseason and not being the starting quarterback. I don't even know who their backup quarterback is, actually, in Jacksonville. Is it Minshew? I don't think it's Minshew. I don't know who it is. But barring that, I think it's going to stay at 3.5. That's my guess. Wanted to, real quickly, before we circle back, before we get to our next show here on the Team 980, I wanted to circle back to the NBA from last night. That was an embarrassing performance by Phoenix and an incredible performance by Luka Doncic, Spencer Dinwiddie, and the Dallas Mavericks. Doncic, had 35 points in 30 minutes. He had 27 in the first half. He did not see the floor in the fourth quarter, nor should he have seen the floor in the fourth quarter. At one point in this game, Dallas on the road as the road team in Game 7 against the team with the best overall record during the regular season in the NBA, they led by 46 points. Now, up next for Dallas in the Western Conference Finals is Golden State. Golden State's a minus 230 favorite, I think Brendan told us earlier in the show. Nobody during the regular season racked up more points and averaged more points against the Warriors in the regular season than Luka Doncic did. He had the fourth most points in a single season against a Steve Kerr-coached Golden State team since he took over back in 2014-2015. Their defense, you know, against Luka Doncic will tell the tale in this series. Now, as far as Spencer Dinwiddie and all of you Wizards fans, I love the trade when they brought him in. I've always been a Spencer Dinwiddie fan. I told you that. He was coming off that ACL surgery. For whatever reason, it didn't work out here. There clearly was a disconnect between he and Beal. Dinwiddie had 30 last night for them, also not in a lot of minutes. He had 21 in the first half. They combined, the two of them did, for 48 of their 57 team points in the first half. They were up 30 at halftime, 57 to 27. Phoenix had 50 points, 50 at the end of the third quarter. I don't know if we'll ever see a Game 7 home team lose the way Phoenix did last night. Very much looking forward to both the Eastern Conference Finals and the Western Conference Finals. Grant Williams, who I loved at Tennessee, had a big game for Boston. Jason Tatum obviously got him to that Game 7 with what he did on Friday night in Milwaukee. But that should be one hell of a series as well. All right. Thanks on the show to both Greg Wyshynski and John Keim. You can listen to any one of those interviews if you miss them by downloading the Odyssey app. Back tomorrow.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.